You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, June 14th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, everyone. How are you doing tonight?
Okay.
Quite well.
Good.
No Rebecca tonight because we are on the lead up to TAM recording schedule. We're going to have a little bit of a weird recording schedule the next few weeks. And Rebecca was not available tonight, and she has no internet access.
That's because her and Sid bought a house.
That's right.
She hasn't been able to get internet and cable, I guess, to the house yet.
Yeah, but it's a big secret. Don't tell anyone, folks.
They're moving into a new flat. Is it still a flat if it's a house?
No, wait. No, a flat's an apartment, isn't it?
Are they moving into a house, or is it like a condo, or what is it?
I think it's a house.
But no cable yet.
Bob, if she has a house, that means she has a basement, which means she could run a haunt in her house.
Not necessarily. Florida houses don't have basements, but that's because of the water table.
Well, no, if she's in England, she has a root cellar.
Yeah, right.
Which is even creepier.
Well, on this date in 1648, Margaret Jones was hanged in Boston for witchcraft, the first such execution for the Massachusetts colony.
How many people were killed?
Yeah, they didn't stop with Margaret. It was 20 people
were executed,
executed for witchcraft.
Wow, and we got off lucky. Didn't in Europe, wasn't it a much bigger phenomenon in Europe?
A conservative number is around 60,000 deaths directly attributable to the witch hunts.
Wow.
Depending on how you count it, whereas there were 20 people executed in Salem, 19 hung, and that one guy, Giles Corey, was crushed to death because he refused to enter a plea. Well, Bob, tell us about Hayabusa returning to Earth.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. I totally forgot about this guy. But this is an interesting story. The Japanese space agency known as JAXA, J-A-X-A, completed a mission recently to bring a sample of an asteroid back to Earth. Now, this is something that's never been accomplished before. And regardless of what happens, there has never been a spacecraft that touched down on an asteroid and then came back to Earth. So regardless if they even brought anything back with them, this was a first. But the only real question that remains as of the taping of this podcast anyway is whether the canister they retrieved in Australia has any asteroid in it. If you remember back in 2003, JAXA's Hayabusa craft began a two-year journey to an asteroid named Itokawa. And I wish I could say the mission went swimmingly, but I can't. The craft really experienced some nasty technical difficulties. It seems like throughout the whole way, or at least through a lot of it, they just kept hitting problem after problem. They even had some solar flare even messed up with its power source, so the energy that it had was less than they had anticipated. And some of the biggest failures, though, was they had this metal ball they planned on shooting at the asteroid to collect rock samples, and that failed. And then there was another mechanism which they were planning on using to stir up the dust around the lander on the asteroid, and that failed as well to collect any samples. So you might think that it was a total bust, but the real hope at this point is that they hope that the dust that was stirred up during the landing kind of just was swirling around and entered the canister, the collection canister. So that's really all their hope is on that.
So they really don't know if there's going to be anything in that canister.
Oh, they have no idea at this point. It doesn't look good to me.
Is it on its way back to Earth, or it can analyze it?
It came back to Earth. The craft burned up in the atmosphere, but it ejected this heat-protected canister, which landed at the Woomera Protected Area, which is a restricted military zone in South Australian desert. Now, some conspiracy hypothesists may say that in reality, this whole seven-year mission was a subtle attempt to get access to this restricted military zone. But, you know, I'm just saying.
Look at that. It landed in Area 51. Can we go get it?
Yeah. But, you know, being silly, but I want to congratulate JAXA, though. Even if there's no sample, which would really be nasty, but even if there's no sample, it was a great effort that tested lots of new technologies for example, like sampling and retrieval, electrical propulsion, autonomous navigation. So lots of interesting new technologies. And this really was a test bed. problems like this are to be expected.
At this point, any kind of space exploration is awesome.
Yeah, right.
You know, in a time when we're worried that it's all going to kind of go away and dry up, you know, I'm really happy to hear about stuff like this.
That's true. But you really got to hand it to JAXA, though, because they relentlessly attacked every difficulty that arose, creatively solving problems. And according to some people, you know, it was Apollo 13, you know, in scale in terms of how difficult these mm-hmm. problems were.
Wow.
But granted, lives were not on the line, but still they had to go through a lot. On the way home, they lost half of their engines kicked out, and they had to figure out how to get home with only half the engines running, and so they did an amazing job.
I don't like you comparing it to Apollo 13, because it being unmanned is one thing, and the other thing was, you know, they got those people back to Earth safely with an enormous amount of effort. I mean, nothing can match that.
Jay, I'm not comparing it, and I did kind of say that, you know, not in terms of the lives, but in terms of creative problem solving, it was similar. Some people are comparing it.
Yeah. Well, if they make a movie about it, I might believe it then.
Yeah, because it's not real unless Hollywood does a movie about it.
As you can imagine, this is a huge, huge news story in Japan. They're really playing it up. It's all over the place because this is, you know, it's quite a feat. You know, regardless of what happens, this is a first. So that's great. If they have a sample, even better, because we learn lots of things about the solar system, because we don't have, think about it, the material we have from asteroids really is just meteorites, right, that have landed on the Earth. And they've gone through the atmosphere. They're not the same. When you come through the atmosphere, they're not the same.
Yeah. This will be pristine.
This will be pristine rock, and that will be invaluable.
Do you guys think that one day we will park satellites in orbit and just mine them?
Oh, yeah, mine asteroids.
You mean bring them into a close orbit, and then we send up vehicles and stuff to start plowing them for their platinum and all their goodies?
Yeah, or how about, you know, one thing that I remember
Absolutely.
Thinking about when I was younger, you know, why not put it in the same orbit that the Earth is in, but just behind the Earth, you know? Would that mean that it would have to be the same size as the Earth, though, in order to be in the same orbit?
The velocity would be very different then. It couldn't have the same velocity because the mass would be so different. So at some point, it would intersect with the Earth. So I don't think that will work, Jay.
You would need something to constantly regulate its distance from the Earth, right?
You put it at a Lagrange point, and it will sit there.
Yeah, there you go.
A Lagrange point is a – if you like have a map, a three-dimensional map of the gravitational fields of the Earth and the Sun, for example, or you know any you know large body orbiting another large body, then those fields hit like a pit or they dip to a minimum. So anything that – is at those points, it's like being at the bottom of a hill. It's stuck there, and it won't move away. So it's actually fixed in position relative to the Earth. So it would be perfect for something that we want to put someplace and have it stay there in terms of its relationship to the Earth.
It's kind of like drafting, right?
No.
Come on, a little bit.
But to complete that discussion, there are a total of 5 Lagrangian points. One in the orbit of, we'll say, the Earth in front of it, one behind the Earth in its orbit, one on the opposite side of Earth's orbit, one between the Earth and the Sun, and one outside the orbit on a line between the Earth and the Sun, but farther than the Earth. So 5 points total, you know, a few of which would be pretty close. But also, you know, there are asteroids that are said to, quote-unquote, stalk the Earth. For example, recently discovered 2009 BD. It's not stationary with respect to the Earth, but it does because it interacts with the Earth's gravity as well, and it's not at a Lagrangian point. But it does get close to the Earth and will sort of corkscrew around the Earth's orbit and stay very close to us for a while and then maybe drift away and come back in its orbit. It's got a very weird orbit, but it does stay close to the Earth. Jay, tell us about the amazing adventure of Einstein's brain.
So this is a very interesting story. But before I get into the story, let me just ask you guys a few questions. You know, one, what makes you think Einstein was so smart? Like, what was it about his brain that makes him smart? Now, some things that I'm sure most skeptics have heard was that Einstein used 10% of his brain, where the regular person only uses 2 or 2.5%. You guys have heard of that one, right?
Oh, of course.
Or something similar to it, yeah.
That's only been debunked about a million times on the internet and elsewhere, and I believe in our own publications. Multiple
of course.
Yep. That's what my phrenologist says.
That's right.
Here's one that is less common, but I've also heard, and I believe I also used to think about this when I was younger and not knowing much about the brain. But another thing that people think is that Einstein's brain had more like hills and valleys in the exterior part of his brain, like the
sulci and gyri.
Yeah, so that's basically the shape of the brain on the outside that makes it look like a brain, all those hills and valleys and you know, like little bumps and stuff that are on the outside of somebody's brain.
Yes.
But Steve, you said at one point that that does not mean you're smarter, correct?
Well, not comparing one individual to another. I mean, there's too much variation to say that. But that certainly is true when you compare species. What the gyri and the sulci do, because it's like if you imagine the layers of the cortex and then folded upon themselves like a ribbon, that's what forms that structure. And what that essentially does is it increases the surface area of the brain. So it's just a way of squeezing more, you know, computational surface area into a smaller three-dimensional space, which was obviously important, the evolution of our bigger, juicier brains. But you can't compare person to person being and go, oh, he's got to be smarter because his brain looks smarter on an MRI scan. He's got more sulci. Doesn't work that
Steve,
way.
Steve, why not just also fill in the valleys between the hills, between the gyri or sulci, whatever they are?
Oh, they're squished. They're squished together. It's not significant.
Okay.
I mean, when you get old and your brain shrivels up, you know, and atrophies, then you see expanded, you know, sulci and spaces.
Man, but your brain really shrivels up, huh?
Yeah, doesn't that suck?
What the hell?
Yeah, but Steve, I thought the idea, though, that behind that was that they're not sure if the brain is really truly atrophying, really hugely impacting, you know, cognition, or is it just like paring away the unessential parts of the brain that really aren't needed?
Yeah, you know, like motor skills and deep thinking.
Well, barring, of course, you know, dementia.
Yeah, right, Bob?
Well, that's a complicated question. First of all, those are not mutually exclusive because both of things could be occurring at the same time. The pruning hypothesis, where it's just sort of cutting back neurons that were sitting there waiting to be recruited, but they haven't been, so they just go away at some point. But even still, you imagine that there's fewer neurons around to be recruited. So, you know, we after 50 or so, we do start to lose our capacity to learn new things. We lose our flexibility, at least most of us. Some people really don't. And their brains don't atrophy as much either.
Bastards.
So just some people just genetically there are built for more neurological longevity. But yeah, you can't. I don't think it's accurate to say that there's no relationship between the atrophy of the brain as we age and loss of cognitive ability. There absolutely is a relationship, but it's complicated, and we're not sure exactly what it is.
Yeah, it's okay. Not a black and white issue. It's more of a gray matter.
Oh
wow, Evan, really? All right, so guys, let me continue. It's basically a story that I'm going to quickly tell everyone, and then we'll discuss it, all right?
I love stories. Okay, I'm ready.
So this man named Thomas Harvey.
Harvey!
Harvey. And he actually performed the autopsy on Einstein at Princeton. This was when, 55, I believe, Einstein died?
Yeah, around there.
Okay, so this is what the article said. The article said that during the autopsy routine, the brain would be removed, examined, and then put back in the person's body for burial. Okay,
which, by the way, we don't do that today. I don't know if that sounds odd. You know, we don't put the brain back in the head. You take it out, you put it in a jar of formaldehyde and pickle it for 2 weeks so that you can slice it up and look at it. Because otherwise it's too much like jelly, you know, you can't really slice into it. So that bit of that story certainly is not what's done today.
Well, maybe he took it out, put it, because he did say that he did put it in formaldehyde.
Well,
maybe
that's routine. That's routine.
He was preparing it, he kept it out for the amount of time necessary, and then instead of putting it back after the examination of the brain, he kept it. All right,
what happened is, because normally you would take it out, you pickle it for 2 weeks, then you do what's called brain cutting. You slice it all the way through, and you look for pathology, and you look for the structures and whatnot, and that's it. Then slides get filed away, and the rest of it gets thrown out, gets discarded as medical waste. What can happen. Sometimes the family may request that every last scrap of material gets returned and gets buried with the body.
All right.
Right.
I'm
so
sure
that happens right. sometimes too. In fact, that happens even with, like, sometimes people will donate their body to science and their body will be dissected by medical students. Sometimes those bodies are just, you know, they're cremated. Other times everything's got to be put back. Not, you don't put it back together, but basically all bundled up and then sent back to the family to be buried or whatever they want to do with it.
Yeah. So that is a typical of Jewish custom. I don't know how religious or close to Einstein was to strict Jewish customs, but I can tell you that is Jewish customs. You bury as much of the remains as you possibly
can. So he probably did, he held back the brain. He didn't do with it whatever was normally supposed to happen to it.
No, he stole it. That's
he stole
that's
it.
What
right.
happened.
Yeah.
Brain. Hey, I'm going to donate my body to science fiction.
Okay. Continuing on.
You stole that joke from somebody.
So Thomas Harvey, because of what he did, because he kept Einstein's brain, he lost his job, which seems to be the appropriate thing to take place.
Because that was unethical to what he did.
And during that process, he claimed that Einstein's son Hans gave him permission, but that claim was denied by the family.
What about Franz?
No. So as I'm reading through this, I realized, you know, of course, hindsight being 2020, I don't disagree with what the guy did. I think it was obvious to him at the time that there was something important about Einstein's brain, and it should be studied further. It shouldn't just be thrown away.
Again, it kind of makes you wish that somebody at NASA thought that about the moon landing footage. You know, I'm gonna put this aside and not. Yeah. File it with the rest of the tapes that are going to get erased and reused, you know?
Yeah, or let's make a couple of backups, you know, just in case. We'll put it maybe somewhere else, I don't know, you know? All right.
Anyway.
Now, I really got to – let me sprint through the rest of this, guys, okay?
All right, go ahead.
Yes.
All right. So I mentioned that I don't disagree. I don't disagree. What Thomas Harvey wanted was he wanted neuroanatomists to analyze Einstein's brain and see if they could find something out about it that we didn't know about the human brain before. And that was his goal. But as the story goes, so 40 years passes, and then a writer named Paterniti, he heard about all these events that we just went through, and he decided that I guess he wanted to write about what had taken place. So he tracks down and finds Harvey. Okay.
Did he sue him?
No, this guy's an author.
So he didn't give him a Paterniti suit?
Oh, my God. You're on a roll tonight, Steve.
What the hell?
Anywho, so he tracks down Harvey, gets into a long conversation with him, and I guess that between the conversation and the two of them going back and forth, they mutually decide, look, the brain should be returned to Einstein's family, and I guess they knew at the time that his granddaughter Evelyn was still alive, so they wanted to return it to her. So Paterniti drives to Harvey's house. He described Harvey as bringing out Einstein's brain in a Tupperware jar, in a Tupperware container.
Yeah. Tupperware.
Okay?
So the two of them, in the freshness, yeah.
The two of them planned to drive across the country from New Jersey all the way to California where the granddaughter lived. I guess their conversation had continued during this drive, and Paterniti found out that Harvey had indeed been sending out Einstein's brain. When samples were requested, he would take the samples and send them to neurologists across the globe. So when he saw the brain in the Tupperware container, it had been cut up. It was sliced up. So Harvey sent three different samples to a scientist named Marion Diamond. And she had contacted Harvey years earlier and requested samples from three different parts of Einstein's brain, and he did end up shipping them to her. But he ended up shipping them to her in an old mayonnaise jar.
Mm-hmm. Okay? Oh, my God.
Not making this up.
Wow.
This was around 1980. She studied the samples. She found that Einstein's brain had a normal amount of neurons, but he had a higher than normal percentage of a different kind of brain cell, and that cell was called a glial cell. That increase in glial cells was found especially in the parts of the brain that involved imagery and complex thinking. So that definitely made Diamond realize, well, this is very curious. Let me look into it. But first, Steve, why don't you tell us what a glial cell is?
Support cells, aren't they?
Yeah, it's the other kinds of cells in the brain other than neurons. And they are, for many years we thought that they were basically support cells.
Like structural cells.
Not just structural, but they create a friendly environment for the neurons.
Okay.
Right, they're there keeping the neurons alive and happy while the neurons are doing their job of remembering and calculating and stuff.
Kind of like the remora around sharks.
I guess.
So at the time, Diamond was now asking questions like, well, why would there be more of these cells here if they're really just support cells? You know, what's the significance of there being more of them here? And it was a very odd idea at the time to think that glial cells had anything to do with Einstein's intelligence. You know, being that the cells were thought to be, there for perhaps structural integrity, perhaps there just to be, like Steve said, like more support cells than actual cells that were there for thinking. All right, so now we go forward another 10 years, and another researcher named Stephen J. Smith published a paper that kind of changed the perception of an understanding of the brain, because what he did was he was studying neurons, and he was also studying these glial cells, and he speculated that glial cells also were a part of the communication that happened within the cell, and that also these cells weren't only communicating chemically, but they were communicating with electricity in the manner that neurons communicate. And then he kept on fleshing out his idea, and he also said that these glial cells could possibly be picking up communication between neurons. So neurons are communicating with each other. Glial cells would be listening in on this communication and then sending that data to other parts of the brain. So he came up with this idea that the brain, it's another way that the brain could be communicating internally, which mm-hmm. At the time was a profound idea. They thought at the time that only neurons were doing the heavy lifting, and that even though there was a ton of other cells in the brain that they didn't think really were doing anything, neurons were it. But once they realized, these glial cells might actually be doing complex things like be involved in learning and memory and, ideas that we have of, like, what does it mean to be a genius? Like, glial cells might have something to do with high-end thinking like that. So once that started to really open up new ideas, and that started, a whole different school of thought. So then yet another scientist named Doug Fields, he reproduced Smith's research and confirmed that it was actually valid. And at one point, Doug Fields wrote, "Now we can see scores of ways in which astrocytes could be involved in many cognitive processes. And now it's not so crazy to find that there were abnormally high numbers of astrocytes in the parts of Einstein's brain involved in imagery and mathematical ability and that sort of thing." So That was a pretty, pretty huge milestone and a huge leap forward in our understanding of the human brain. So in 2007, Harvey died. He really didn't know that him taking Einstein's brain actually through these steps and through these different people actually led to a move forward in our understanding of the riddle of the mind. But, it seems that he actually did have something to do with it. And Einstein's granddaughter didn't end up wanting her grandfather's brain, so Harvey, before he died, he returned the brain back to the pathology department at Princeton, where it is today.
Hey, can you only find out the number of astrocytes by cutting into a brain, or is there a way to test it while you're still alive?
Yeah, I mean, you can estimate it just by knowing what the density of astrocytes are and then calculating it by volume. But if you want to look at like an individual's astrocyte density, yeah, you got to stain it. You got to cut into it.
So, Steve, could you just take a little... take a biopsy of somebody's brain and test it that way?
Yeah.
I don't think you can do...
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah. Well, are you supposed to be biopsying the brain for this kind of testing purposes? It's really more for... Right.
Well, you wouldn't do this.
Disease.
You wouldn't do that. You wouldn't biopsy someone's brain just out of curiosity. But we do it for diagnostic purposes, but it's got to be worthwhile to the person.
Right. There's got to be something going on that... You're looking for the answer to a cure or something.
Risk benefit.
Steve, I know it's not uncommon. Brain surgery happens all the time. They open up people's skulls. They literally get in there with tools and go deep into the brain and remove tumors and do things like that. Cognitively, if you did take someone's skull off or a portion of the skull and just cut out, like say, jelly bean sized piece of the brain,
mm-hmm.
and under the idea that the person isn't going to bleed to death or whatever, just removing a piece of the brain,
yeah,
and then putting the skull piece back and letting the person heal, you know, what would they lose from losing a portion of the brain that size?
Depends. It depends on the portion.
You're lobotomizing a person at that point.
It totally depends. My guess would be that either it's completely unnoticeable or you'd be completely debilitated.
Bob's right. It completely depends on which jelly bean piece of brain take out.
So take the hypothalamus and you're effed.
Like, for example, the right frontal lobe is largely redundant. And you could do a lot of stuff to that without producing any noticeable deficits. And in fact, you know, when surgeons have to go into the brain, they prefer to do the non-dominant frontal lobe because it's mostly redundant. But you take out the language cortex, and you can make somebody completely lose their ability to speak, for example.
It'd be like a stroke, Jay. It'd be like a stroke.
But even a piece that small, because
if it's critical, yeah.
So there is one place in your brain that, you know, certain type of functionality is happening, and there's parts of your brain which is just storage for memory. There's parts of your brain that are doing something like processing, you know, what you see or what you hear. So you're better off losing a little portion of your memory than you are like a major piece of functionality, of course. But I thought it was more evenly distributed.
No. It's not, and it's also. I mean, memory's pretty evenly distributed, but functions are localized, and there's also it's not just how localized it is; it's how redundant it is. If something's really lateralized to one side, you only have one piece of your brain that's doing that thing, then you don't want to lose that. If you have bilateral redundancy, then obviously it's you can afford to lose one because the other side will make up for it. So, yeah, it depends on a lot of things. Interestingly, when reading through Science News items this week, just this week was a study published by Swedish researchers from the University of Gothenburg, and they were looking at astrocytes, which are a form of glial cells, and their effects on neuronal connections and function. And essentially what they found is that the astrocytes are modulating the strength of the signaling between the neurons. Now, they basically are affecting how those synapses between neurons change over time. So what that means is that the astrocytes might actually be directly involved in the formation of memories and plasticity of the brain and learning, you know, which, again, is just further evidence for their greatly enhanced role in actual, you know, memory function of the brain, not just, again, as support cells. So that research is ongoing, and that was a huge shift in our thinking about the role of astrocytes. Well, let's go on. We have another bit of astronomy news, Bob. You're going to tell us about the largest radio telescope ever.
Yeah, this was a quickie. This is the biggest radio telescope in the world, and it was recently unveiled by scientists in the Netherlands. It's called LOFAR, which stands for Low Frequency Array. I think we touched upon this a while back. It consists of a whopping 25,000 small antennas, and they're real tiny. They range in size from 50 centimeters to about 2 meters across, so they're not very big at all. And they're all spread out all over not only the Netherlands, but also Germany, Sweden, France, and Britain. And it's pretty cool. This thing is going to really do some amazing work, I predict. Femke Beckhurst of the Netherlands Radio Astronomy Institute said, "Today we have launched the biggest radio telescope in the world. When you combine all the antennas, you get a giant telescope with a diameter of about 1,000 kilometers, which is about 600 miles. So that's pretty big, and it takes some nifty software to actually take all those separate signals and kind of stitch them together. They're actually using a supercomputer to do some of that work. It's the BlueJean P supercomputer, which is a petaflop class supercomputer. So it's pretty fast. So with these observations that this radio telescope, or you know, I guess you can call it radio telescopes. So the observations that they're going to be able to make with this, they're going to learn about the origin of the universe. And some people are saying that they'll be able to go to the moment right after the Big Bang. And some other key science projects for LOFAR are what they call the epoch of reionization, which is basically when the universe turned on, when things became luminous. Also, things like ultra-high energy cosmic rays, which are a bit of a mystery, such as the one we mentioned, one such cosmic ray a while back called the Oh My God particle in 1991, which was probably the most energetic cosmic ray ever detected, which was so powerful. Imagine it was a subatomic particle with the energy of a baseball traveling at 60 miles an hour. So imagine you get hit with one proton and it knocks you on your butt like it was a baseball traveling 60. So amazingly fast. We're not sure what could have imparted so much energy to such a tiny thing. It was traveling so close to the speed of light. It was essentially just a whisker.
Yeah, but to clarify, it wouldn't really knock you on your butt, right? Because it would just go right through you.
No, it's too. Yeah, it's too tiny. Right. Yeah. It is too tiny, and it could do some damage though. If it happened to hit the right whatever in your body, DNA or something.
Well, what if it hit a computer or something? Right. It would really screw that up.
That's a lot of kinetic energy. I don't know where. You know, how all that kinetic energy would be transferred. Would it be transferred into heat? Would it fly right through? Probably it might just fly right through.
Or maybe it will hit smash through several particles on its way. But
yeah, if it hits something squarely, it could start a cascade. So I think if it's just right, it could be noticeable. But there's other things, the solar science and space weather, cosmic magnetism. So I'm sure this thing is going to be used for a really long time, and hopefully maybe even get even bigger.
Hey, Bob, what's the difference between the Big Bang, moment of the Big Bang, and the moment of first luminosity, I think is the word used.
I believe it was 100,000 years or 1,000 years. It was a lot of time before things calmed down enough. Things were just so energetic that light, any photons that might have been generated were just bouncing around all over the place, and they really couldn't kind of just settle down and just take a straight line in any direction. So there's nothing to see if you look back in visible light. There's nothing to see because all the photons were just kind of bouncing around. But also this epoch of reionization, that's kind of a different term than I'm used to. They refer to it as when things became luminous. So I think it depends on – are they talking about – the first stars, the first galaxies, the first quasars,
that's
what they're talking about, then that would actually be after what I've just mentioned, which is also called photon decoupling. So actually this epoch is a little bit different. I think it's later on.
Well, it's just amazing that they can make that distinction or make the determination that so much, however much time it is, happened between the two. You know, you think of the Big Bang, certainly in a visual display, you're watching some show on TV that kind of describes it, and it's an intense white spot of light from the get-go. At least that's how they depict it. So
they always give you the impossible perspective of being outside the universe when the Big Bang
space time, right?
But that's not a possible perspective, so it's kind of misleading.
Yeah, a little.
And a lot of that is evidence. It's theoretical. I mean, they're just saying what should have happened if you have the mass of the universe, you know, at a point, and then what would happen over time. You know, it's based upon the temperatures and what things are like at those temperatures. You know what I mean?
But and maybe this large radio telescope will help fill in those gaps.
So right. Some of them.
Hopefully.
If it can actually get close to the moment after the Big Bang, then absolutely it'll be able to do – it'll illuminate us in many ways.
Very cool.
I still don't get the concept that when the Big Bang took place, like where it was spatially in reality – like you can't go to that space, that place in outer space, because it doesn't really.
Sure, you can. Just wherever you go, there you are.
Oh, jeez, really, Bob?
It happened everywhere.
It's true. It's true. It's everywhere. You can't point to it because it's not one specific spot. It's everywhere.
Well, it didn't happen right here.
It might have.
But every part of the universe was at that point, Jay, at that time.
Yeah. So that would, you know, meaning that the universe is growing in size.
Of course. But it's like, you know, if you do the two-dimensional analogy, it's like blowing up a balloon. Well, where was it before you blew it up? Well, it's
tried explaining to a two-dimensional creature on that balloon.
Yeah,
where the center is.
You'd have to point into the fourth dimension.
I can't picture it.
Right. So the Amityville Horror House is back in the news,
and it's back in the news because it's up for sale.
Sale? That's right. For what? At $1.5 million.
$1.15 million.
In this market,
you can own a piece of paranormal history.
But is that price kind of crazy for the neighborhood because the house is famous?
I don't know. I imagine that has something to do with it. They said they'd done a lot of renovations recently on the house. So, look, imagine the main factor, like any other piece of property, is
location.
You know, location and comparable houses for sale in the area.
But here's my question. Now, typically, if a house is alleged to be haunted or if a murder took place there, it's considered psychologically damaged, and that actually reduces the value of the house. But in this case, it's famous for being psychologically damaged. So does that increase the value of the house?
Or the two equal each other out, the negative and the positive balance out.
Right.
Yeah. So there were a series of murders there in 1974.
Mm-hmm.
Ronald DeFeo Sr., his wife Louise, their two sons and two daughters were shot while they slept in the home. And the one remaining family member alive, Ronald, nicknamed Butch DeFeo, he confessed to the murders and is serving a life sentence in prison. And then just a few weeks after the sentencing of Butch, George and Kathy Lutz and their three children moved into the home, where a new round of supposed horrors began.
Tell us
about
them.
Well, not really. Oh, there was supposedly all sorts of things happening in this house. They reported sightings of, well, the kids reported sightings of animals, and mostly a pig named Jody. A sculpted lion came to life and supposedly walked around the house.
Cool.
A demonic boy appeared. It was photographed. And you can find that famous photograph online. Kind of looks like a regular boy, but that's beside the point. And other strange things in the house. Oh, green slime oozed from the walls. A crucifix on the wall was constantly rotating until it left itself upside down. And needless to say, 28 days after they moved in...
28 days
the family,
later.
28 days later. Good one, Steve. The Lutzes fled.
What about the? What about you? Forgot about that? The hell mouth, it's a gaping mouth to hell in their basement.
Wait, wasn't that in?
That was
in
a Poltergeist movie, I think. No. You're right,
Steve. It's a red room.
Yeah, it was a red room, which in the movie they kind of made it seem like it was like the road to hell or something.
Now there was one small problem with all of these paranormal happenings. They never really happened. It's a small. It was a story
that
concocted.
It was fake.
The whole thing was fake. However, that didn't stop famous demonologist and psychic investigator, paranormal investigator, Ed Warren and his wife Lorraine, from investigating the matter and deeming that house to be one of the most haunted places in the world.
Right after their basement.
That's right. Their basement in Monroe, Connecticut, number one. Amityville, number two.
That's right. Right. It was fake. And now it's up for sale.
It is. So, if you got dollars burning a hole in your pocket,
right.
You might want to go get a piece of history.
The people who bought the house after the Lutzes complained that they had to deal with the paranormal tourists bothering them day in and day out, you know, gawking at the house and everything.
So much so that they had to change the address of the house.
Yeah. So it really was psychologically damaged for them because it came with all the tourists.
Yeah, right.
So I'm looking at a picture of the demon boy.
Yeah.
It's a little boy.
With no eyes. Right.
Well, not, you know, the eyes are whited out, so it looks kind of creepy. Photo could have been
Could be
doctored
a dozen
up.
Things, right, other than a demonic boy from hell.
Well, thanks for that, Evan. And why don't we go on to Who's That Noisy?
Okay, for those of you who forgot, here is last week's Who's That Noisy?
And then I began to study back the relationships between the elements for plants, and they are different as the elements for humans, because Kali and Phosphor are actually the friends of each other in the homeopathic Materia Medica for humans, but in plants, these two substances are each other's enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, you learned a little bit about homeopathy in that clip.
That's right. Two substances which are enemies in plants are friends in people or animals.
Huh.
bet you didn't know that before.
So, who is that guy?
That is V.D. Kaviraj, a homeopath of some repute. And the reason I actually found this person is because I was watching a YouTube video of our, well, friend, Mr. Beneth,
right,
who had this fellow on as part of an interview. So I thought that would make a rather interesting noisy last week.
Right.
And not only did someone get it correctly, but they actually also went ahead and found the clip from which I clipped it. So if you go on to our message boards and episode 256, you can actually take a look and listen for yourself to the entire interview and bring some coffee because you will otherwise fall asleep.
You want your brain to explode, yeah.
Exactly. So Nowoo, N-O-W-O-O, from the message boards. Guessed correctly. Congratulations. Well done.
And what do you got for this week, Evan?
Okay, and here is this week's Who's That Noisy?
Does the SHA give you the authority you need to take dangerous products off the shelf? And the answer is always yes.
That's a short one this week.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
But I think there's enough information in there for someone to get it, so be the first one to guess correctly. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Ev. We have time for a few emails this week. The first one comes from Michael Wilson from Prescott, Arizona, and Michael writes, Steve, you made the offhand comment that there are serious concerns that soy milk is producing an estrogen-type hormonal effect. I am a vegan bodybuilder who drinks a quart of soy milk every day. I am concerned your offhand comment will scare people away from switching to a healthier milk alternative with no saturated fat. I've looked in the past when people have made these claims, and all I could find is that there may be some very mild effect, but nothing that rises to the level of your serious concern comment. If there was, there would be serious estrogen-related issues throughout Asian countries. Since you felt it necessary to scare people away from soy by telling them about the serious concerns science has with soy milk, I hope you will provide the research on your next show that provides soy milk causes serious estrogen-like effects. I do love the show, and I thank you, and I thank everyone for the time and effort you guys put into it every week. So Michael's referring to 2 weeks ago when we had Pamela Gay and Fraser Cain on. When we, I can't remember what we were talking about, but the notion of
Pamela said she drinks soy milk.
She's
and
soy
then
milk.
Got into the
yeah, so I was razzing her a little bit about the fact that not everything is, you know, perfectly safe. You could find concerns about anything, and the fact that there are concerns about the estrogen-like effects of soy milk. But it was an offhand comment, but I do think it's a good for follow-up to see what the evidence actually shows. The concerns are raised by the fact that soy contains isoflavones, which have an estrogen effect. It's hormonally active. And therefore, that creates the plausibility that it could have some actual clinical effects in people, and there are various populations in which it has been studied. So one group are women who are women in general, especially women who have had breast cancer. The question is, do the estrogens increase the risk of breast cancer, or if you have breast cancer, does it worsen the outcome? The answer to that question appears to be no. So the evidence so far is pretty solid that there's no negative effect for women with breast cancer. In fact, one review I read said that there may in fact be a small beneficial effect, because it may competitively block the effects of women who have high estrogen levels. So there it's either no effect or maybe a small beneficial effect in a subset of women. The bigger concerns are with men, though, because, you know, obviously estrogen is a feminizing hormone, and the question is, do the estrogen effects of isoflavones in soy milk have a feminizing effect on men? So far, the research does not show any such effect. What about the reproductive effects on men? Here, we have animal data, which shows that there is a negative effect, so that this is where the biggest concerns are. And these concerns are that we haven't done enough research to really know what the net effects are in people. So we have animal data that shows some concern, but not really sufficient human data to rule out that there may be a negative effect on the reproduction of men. The final group are infants, especially since there is a, you know, soy-based infant formulas. And here, there were several reviews in the last couple of years, some saying there's really no proven effect, other reviewers saying that, again, there is concern that there may be some hormonal effects on infants, and essentially where the reviewers agree is that the research is not adequate to rule out a significant effect. Therefore, if you want to be cautious, you may avoid using soy-based infant formulas until more research is done to show that there isn't any significant hormonal effect, estrogen-like effect. So that's where we are. Like, I do think it's fair to say that there are concerns. Nothing is proven. And while some of those concerns have been ruled out by research, there are others, specifically reproduction in men and in infants, where we don't have enough research to really say that they're safe. My take is that it's probably a very weak effect. And I would be surprised if the research ultimately showed that there was a strong effect. But those are the areas where the research is not yet sufficient to confidently say that there isn't a potential effect.
So, but for this guy, Steve, if you're not an infant and you're beyond, you've already had your kids and you're done with kids, then it would be even less of a concern.
That's right. And if you're a woman, there's basically no concern.
Okay.
Right. Jay, you're going to tell us about the cursed cell phone number.
Yeah, this is really silly, to be honest
it's
with you,
silly.
Right? This is just one
silly.
One of those stories where there's a string of coincidences that could make certain people think certain things. But basically, there was a phone number that was given out. And I don't know if this is the real number, but it seems like it isn't, because it's a series. It's 0888888888, you know.
No, that's the number. I mean, my understanding from reading is that that's the number that they suspended.
Okay. You know, it could be. Isn't the number 8 unlucky somewhere?
No, it's lucky in Asian cultures, isn't 8 is lucky. So
4 is unlucky.
4 is unlucky because it sounds like
death. Yeah, right.
4 is unlucky.
So here's the quick one. The quick one, too. The first person who got it, he was the former CEO of a Bulgarian mobile phone company. His company issued him the number. Okay?
Yeah.
He died of cancer in 2001 at 48 years old. After he died, some rumors came out that his cancer had been caused by a business rival using radioactive poisoning. I find that unlikely, but okay, even take that away. Let's just say the guy died. It was horrible. Died of cancer in 2001, 48 years old. That was horrible. The second guy that got the number was a Bulgarian mafia boss. There's a couple of things that mafia bosses do really well. They kill and then they get killed.
Right.
Right? This guy was gunned down in 2003 by an assassin.
What are the odds?
Yeah, right.
Right.
A mafia killing? What?
Then the number went to another guy who was described as a crooked businessman, and he was gunned down outside of an Indian restaurant in Bulgaria.
Mm-hmm.
So since then, the number was retired because the police are investigating and all this stuff. But you know, there's the idea that the number is cursed or unlucky.
Or jinxed.
It's your unlucky number.
It's the number has been touched by evil, and anyone who gets it is going to get killed. Something, you know.
Anyone mob related who touches it will get killed.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear to see through this. It's not that big of a coincidence that a bunch of people that were involved in very dangerous and crazy criminal activity are getting killed.
Mm-hmm.
But if a number becomes available, is it more likely that the number became available because somebody dumped the number or because somebody died? Because I'm never going to want to lose my number today.
Yeah, I don't know. Now that people have personal phone numbers, yeah, probably people hold on to them for life, you know? Even if you change carrier, right, you can take your number to another carrier.
Yeah, now you can. Maybe I don't know if you could in early 2003. I don't know if you could during that time period. So anyway, the reason why we bring up this story was not just because somebody wrote in about it, but we thought it was just a quick and easy example of a series of events strung together to make a story where there really isn't a story or a connection.
Yeah, there's a few ways you can look at this. One is it's not that big a coincidence that three people with the same number die in a short period of time. Just taking the number of phone numbers out there, I'm sure that happens a lot just by coincidence, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, would it be surprising if that never happened? This is a little different because these people were high profile and the number's unusual. It's you could think of it as a very desirable number because it's all eights. It's the kind of thing that the kind of number you get if you work for the phone company, like the CEO, or you're a mob boss, I guess. Right, they're not going to give it to just some guy, and these two of these three people were at high risk for dying, so that makes it even less of a coincidence that then this kind of number is going to go to the kind of people who may be, you know, in risky businesses. But then you also think about it from the phone company's point of view. You know, obviously the notion that the number itself is jinxed is magical thinking and it's ridiculous. But from a business marketing point of view, do they want to hand this number over to somebody else? And then, you know, what if something happens to that person, or even that they may just get upset if they find out that the phone company assigned them a quote-unquote jinxed number? You know what I mean? It's probably just fewer headaches for the phone company if they just get rid of it, even for a while. You know what I mean? You hear it?
Yeah, it's a numbers racket.
That's yes.
It's good job, boys.
That's good work, boys.
The next one comes from David Gardner from Osaka, Japan. And David writes, "One of the branches of the company I work for in Japan has started selling propolis as a means to make more money in a bad economy. This branch has repeatedly tried to get me to buy some of this magic bee juice. Many of my Japanese coworkers have taken the bait. They are putting bee juice in their drinks and swallowing magic bee juice pills. When I ask them if they feel any better, all they could say is they aren't sure. I think the company I work for has a snake oil division. Do you know of any scientific evidence that shows any benefit to taking propolis? All the information I found says that propolis may contain lead or other garbage bees pick up while flying around the city. Thank you for your time." Well, do you guys know what propolis is?
Nope.
No.
It's the star in the sky that doesn't rotate.
Yeah. It's magic bee juice. Position. Now, this is bees make a variety of things. This is the gooey, sticky stuff that bees use to hold together their nests. They largely pick it up.
The honeycomb?
I guess so. Yeah, but it's not just wax. I guess this is like even stronger structural stuff that they use. It's like the it's like the glue that they use to hold it together, and it's like they'll pick up the sap from coniferous trees, you know. And it's resins. It sounds nasty. It doesn't sound like the kind of stuff you would want to eat. I mean, the bees don't eat it. It contains phenolics, aromatic compounds, volatile oils, and terpenes. But even worse than that, as the bees fly around, you know, our modern society, they're not just picking up resins from pine trees. They're also picking up lead paint. They're picking up caulking. You know, they're picking up road tar and other things. So they're
fecal material.
Yeah, they're picking up all kinds of nasty stuff and mixing it all together with these resins and terpenes, and they're using that to glue together their nest. And idiots are taking that stuff and eating it.
Now,
Steve,
you say
is it glue like?
It's sticky. It's like a, you know, you ever get the sap off a pine tree? It's like that.
Yeah, it's awful.
Now, of course, it contains a lot of chemicals, right? As you might,
it's all natural.
As you might imagine, sure. And and if you look at those chemicals do stuff. You know, the body's going to react to those chemicals. But actually, probably the most common reaction is an allergic dermatitis. And when I looked up, you know, propolis on PubMed, I found most of the specific references to it in people were to, you know, this allergic dermatitis.
Is this the same allergic reaction people have when they get a bee sting?
No,
no.
It the same? It's different. This is more just like a contact dermatitis. You know, the skin gets red and you know, bee stings can have more of a systemic reaction. That's where it becomes a problem as opposed to just a rash. So there's no research in humans showing any beneficial effects. You know, it's all extrapolating wildly from just non-specific or just reactions that happen to some chemical that you can find in this stuff. There's some animal data that it, you know, does stuff, but there's nothing that really can be used to base any kind of medicinal claims. So this really is snake oil. And apparently it's been around for hundreds of years. This is nothing new. It's just the kind of thing that crops up every now and then.
Here, eat this bee waste.
Yeah, it's bee waste. It is bee waste.
Bee waste.
Pretty much everything that bees make, you know, somebody has decided to sell as snake oil. Pollen, royal jelly, and even bee venom. You guys have heard. I've talked about bee venom therapy.
Bee venom therapy, yeah, sure.
For multiple sclerosis and arthritis and things like that. Pretty much everything. The only thing that bees make that has real medicinal value is honey. and only if you put it topically on your wound.
Or on toast.
I love honey.
I love you too, honey.
It never spoils.
Well, we actually have a Name That Logical Fallacy this week.
Ooh.
This one to cue the music.
This is a question. It comes from some guy called Mike Lassell in Canada.
Who is he?
That's a funny
I don't know, some ball guy.
Oh.
And Mike wants to know.
Hey, Mike, but despite Mike that. Will be at TAM this year, by the way.
Oh, this guy's going to be at TAM?
Yes.
Oh, I can't wait to meet him.
I'm not going now.
I'll see you there, Mike.
Mike writes, I'm trying to figure out the difference between the incorrect cause fallacy and the post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy. Skeptic Wiki is telling me that post hoc is a type of incorrect cause fallacy, but I'm not getting the difference. They seem to be one and the same. Any help would be appreciated. So this is an interesting one. The incorrect cause fallacy is actually a category of logical fallacies.
Yeah, there's lots of and the post hoc is just a subcategory of it.
Exactly, it's one and, type. It's any
right.
it's any fallacy where you are making an invalid inference as to cause and effect. That's the incorrect cause fallacy. I had a couple of back and forths with Mike, and he was saying that if you invoke the wrong cause for something just because your information is incorrect, is that an incorrect cause fallacy? And the answer to that is no. It doesn't mean that you're just mistaken about what causes what. That's just a false premise. It's that the logical inference is incorrect. Because that's what a logical fallacy is. So in the post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy, you're concluding that B is caused by A because B follows A. That's where the invalid logic comes in. Is you're reaching the conclusion not because you just have a mistaken belief, but because you think that the fact that it comes after it is how you know that it's being caused by it.
Right. So it's more sequential, whereas the incorrect cause fallacy, it could be
is anything.
It could be after. It could be anything.
Could go any
it could
direction.
Be, they could happen at the same exact time. You know, it couldn't be, you know, it could be AB instead of A followed by B. You know, it could be at the same time or even other variations. So that's the main distinction. As
yeah.
I see
and it's not even restricted to temporal, but another common incorrect cause fallacy is the assuming causation from correlation, as you're saying. They're
yeah.
correlated in some way, not because necessarily one follows the other, but they could just be happening together more frequently or at the same time. And then you assume that they're happening together because one is causing the other, when in fact there are many relationships that are possible. You cannot infer a specific causal relationship. Often people, however, say that, and I hear this people say this or write this all the time, that correlation does not imply causation. And that's incorrect. It does imply causation. It just doesn't equal causation.
Right, right.
You know, sometimes correlations occur because there is causation, and it certainly does imply that. It's one piece of evidence. But in order to make a specific causal conclusion, you have to line up multiple correlations. Other examples of this would include the complex cause fallacy, where maybe there are multiple causations, but you pick one out and say that's the cause.
Yeah.
That's a very common one, right? We all sort of unconsciously do that all the time, where we tend to think simplistically in terms of one cause for things, when in fact many complex things will have multiple causes that are not mutually exclusive.
And it's not just one cause. It could also be the most interesting cause has got to be it too, right?
Yeah.
We're so drawn to the one that's
interesting,
so sexy.
Or the one that confirms our prior beliefs and ideology.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, confirmation bias.
Then there's the regression fallacy. This is where you assume cause and effect because of what is ultimately regression to the mean. Like, here's an example. Appearing on the cover of Sports Illustrated is a curse that will cause them to have a bad season or a bad game or whatever following
I've
that.
I've heard that before.
Yeah, the Sports Illustrated curse. But that can be explained by regression to the mean.
Right, they were on the cover in the first place because they just happened to have, say, an exceptional season, right? And
yes.
Then, of course, you know, the regression to the mean's got to kick in at some point. You would think, and then it's like, oh, damn, bad luck.
Yeah, they had their best game, their best season, whatever. That gets them on the cover, and any extreme is likely to be followed by something closer to the mean, the regression to the mean.
Right. Just, oh, that's gotcha. But very similar to the droning on fallacy, where skeptical enthusiasts just keep talking about logical fallacies over and over again.
Jay, I'm not familiar with that one.
Cool. I'm not either. Hey, here's another logical fallacy.
So what you're saying, Jay, is that you want to move on to science or fiction. Is that what you're saying?
It's time for science.
All right, we'll kick in the real music.
Fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Yes.
You can't
yes.
make me play. All right, I'll play.
All right, here we go. Item number one. NIST scientists have developed a dark laser that is endothermic. It takes heat away from an object on which it is focused. Item number two. A new analysis suggests that many comets, including well-known comets like Halley's and Hale-Bopp, originated from other solar systems. Item number three, scientists report a fivefold increase in the growth of rice plants from manipulating the genetics of a fungus that grow on its roots. Jay, go first.
Well, okay, so I think that the laser, the dark laser one that takes heat away from an object that it's focused on, that seems a little shifty to me. I don't see how I wasn't aware that laser light had a temperature either. I never really thought about that. And the second one about the comets that coming from other solar systems, you know, I think that one's the fake.
The comets?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Evan?
The dark laser is interesting. Taking heat away from an object on which it's focused. How exactly is it doing that? I absolutely don't know. Is it a laser at that point? It's a beam of light? That takes heat away from an object on which it's focused. That's fascinating. That's the most fascinating of these three. The one about the comets originating from other solar systems seems very plausible. I guess you could argue that nothing is original in this solar system and that everything came from another place somewhere else. Other explosions, other events that occur on a regular basis, so I think that one's rather plausible. I don't know why it's necessarily a new analysis, though. The last one was the fivefold increase in the growth of rice plants. All right, so you have a fungus on the rice plant. You manipulate the genetics of the fungus, and it increases the yield times five. Boy, I think the comets one is correct. I'm between this dark laser and this fungus. I'm just going to have to guess at this point. I'm going to say the fungus one is the fiction. I don't think that's right.
Okay, Bob.
The comet one, yeah, that's unusual. I mean, you've got the Oort cloud, big, huge cloud of comets. It was always pretty much assumed or stated directly that they're just part of the solar system. The fact that they could have been captured or from another solar system is news to me. I could see it. I could see how we did capture them, but I mean, we're talking billions of comets out there. That's an interesting one. So you increase the yield of rice by manipulating the genetics of the fungus growing on the roots. I mean, that makes perfect sense to me. Who knows? Perhaps the fungus were siphoning off nutrients that would have been going to the rice, and so you cut back on their take of the nutrients, and so more goes to the rice, less goes to the fungus, so you've got greater growth. I mean, that's totally plausible, and actually an awesome application of genetic manipulation. I mean, how valuable will that be? It's almost too good. The first one, the dark laser, an endothermic laser. I know a little bit about lasers. I can't imagine off the top of my head how it's going to be taking away heat. I mean, you're focusing radiation on an object. I mean, perhaps you're knocking away you're somehow knocking away the most energetic molecules or atoms, and you're lowering the average temperature, kind of like, I think that's similar to like evaporative cooling. But still, I mean, I can't decide between that and the fungus. I can kind of make an argument, but I hope the fungus one is true, and I'm going to say that the laser one is fiction.
All right, so you guys are evenly divided.
Guess so.
Doesn't happen very often.
All right, so I guess I'll take these in order. Item number one, NIST scientists have developed a dark laser that is endothermic. It takes heat away from an object on which it is focused. And I should mention that NIST stands for the National Institute of Standards and Science. Technology. And also that dark laser was a character from...
Ha! Yes, Timmy?
Timmy Turner, yeah. Fairly Odd Parents.
Oh, my God.
And that one is the fiction.
Yeah, baby.
Job, Bob. And yeah, it was. I did take it from another story. So that's one, if you had like read the headline only, you might have gotten sucked into it. But if you actually read the article, then
I dug deeper.
So, yeah, I couldn't find anything about an endothermic laser, so I figured I was safe for that, but who knows?
Yeah, but I think you are.
What the story is about a dark pulse laser. Now, a pulse laser is a laser where there are pulses of increase in brightness. This is a dark pulse laser where there are pulses of decreases in brightness, right? So you have a laser humming along, and then at certain intervals, there are dropouts, essentially, of the brightness of the laser. And they were able to make these ultra-short pulses, just 90 picoseconds, or trillionths of a second. They think that this device could be very useful for communication. So this could have a lot of applications. So, interesting.
Yeah, but another way to look at it, Steve, was that before this, they would, you know, when information was coming, when they would encode information, when they pulse a laser, I mean, that was kind of like the information, and then there'd be a pause, and they would pulse more information. And that, you know, that would basically be the information, but this is the opposite.
Yeah.
When the light's hitting, it's considered no information, but when there's nothing coming, then that's considered, the thrust of the information, which is, it's kind of odd, but that's kind of how I took it.
No, I think so, but
the opposite.
The advantage is that they can pulse it much faster with much smaller pulses. I think that's
right.
Why this approach may have some advantages, right.
And that is awesome because, man, you get down to picoseconds, they're getting so brief, so incredibly brief that, that seems like an awesome idea.
Let's go to number two. A new analysis suggests that many comets, including well-known comets like Halley's and Hale-Bopp, originated from other solar systems. That one is science. And this is a computer simulation that – this one's actually been around for a couple of days, so I figured some of you might have read it, but – that what essentially astronomers did, this is Hal Levison, Martin Duncan from Queen's University in Kingston, Canada, and Raymond Brasser from France, and David Kaufman. What they did was they were investigating, mainly through computer simulations, the formation of our sun. Now, our sun formed in a stellar nursery, like most stars do, right? So when the star first formed, it was surrounded closely by a lot of other stars. But eventually, when some of those stars went supernova, it blew away a lot of the gas clouds, and that's what pretty much ended the stellar nursery, and then eventually, you know, the suns went their own way. But while they were still close together, what they surmise is that large planets in those systems would routinely fling out any small objects like comets into basically just a cloud of interstellar space, right, among all these stars in the nursery. And that when the stars went their own way, they would just capture a random assortment of these interstellar comets and take them with them because they just got captured by that star's gravity. Right? So that may be why we have this cloud of comets around our sun. They were just all captured from this bigger cloud that was permeating, you know, this cluster of young stars in the stellar nursery. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but so many of them. I mean, I've heard estimates up in the billions.
Why not? Why not? I mean, it's, you know, it's basically all the stars were sharing their comets, you know, into one massive Oort cloud, and then until our sun went its own way and just captured a bunch of them and took them away.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so I mean, this obviously needs empirical confirmation. Right now, it's just a computer model, but it's an interesting idea, and it would mean
good luck. They're like a light year away. I mean, they are far away. They are the, you know, pretty much by definition the farthest outskirts of the solar system.
And wouldn't that make sense, Bob? That something so far out was captured, you know, by nearby stars. And Evan, to clarify, you said that, you know, everything is eventually from other stellar systems, and that's true of a second generation star. By definition, everything in our solar system was previously in another solar system. But these were, when we say that the comet came from another solar system, that means after it condensed down into a comet, you know, not just the raw material that went into it, but after it was already a comet, then it got captured.
I gotcha.
Just to clarify that one point.
Yes.
And let's go on to number three. Scientists report a fivefold increase in the growth of rice plants from manipulating the genetics of a fungus that grows on its roots. And that one is also science.
Cool.
And let me clarify a couple of things also that you guys said.
Wait. Can you hear Bob gushing because he won this week?
Oh, yeah.
He's like, oh, cool. Yeah.
Jay's coming off he's coming off of 2 weeks in a row losing, so he's just happy it wasn't three in a row.
Jay, you have no idea what that's like, Jay.
Oh, I really don't. I really have no idea.
So, Bob, both you and Evan, if I heard correctly, said that the yield of the rice increased by fivefold, but I didn't write or say that. It's the growth of the rice plants.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, so the actual
physical size of the
growth. Or the rate of growth. I mean, it said growth, so that's what I wrote. It specifically did not say yield. Yield is what we're interested in, though, right? So I don't know how that translates into yield. The other caveat that wasn't part of what I said is that this was done in a greenhouse, so not in rice paddies. So this was just in a lab, you know, greenhouse somewhere.
Well, yeah, we'd start there.
Well,
right?
Yeah, then but just to say, I mean, we'd have to know how it translates into a completely natural environment.
Well, yeah, details.
Now, but Bob, you got the effect of the fungus backwards. This is a fungus.
Really?
This is a fungus that actually increases the growth of the plant. It does not detract from it.
Oh, wow.
And how do you think it does that?
It supports it. It's a symbiotic relationship then.
Yeah,
it supports it. And
it's supplying nutrients to the rice.
Right. You let me use your roots and I'll get you some good juice.
Yeah, basically it supplies phosphate. That's what it does, which is a very limiting nutrient for plants. The fungus is mycorrhizal species. The specific species is Glomus intraradices. And this has a very interesting genetics in that one filament of this fungus can contain many genetically distinct nuclei. So basically like different assortments of its own genes in different parts of itself. So they were able, I say it was not genetic engineering, it was just genetic manipulation. They were just, you know, using techniques to choose which subset of the genes of this fungus they were going to express. And they were able to find an assortment that provided a lot more phosphate to the rice roots. And actually,
well, how did they select it? Was it just
the report was vague on the details, but it made it sound like cultivation. Yeah, just breeding and cultivation, no genetic engineering.
Aha!
And yeah, they found one, you know, genetic version of this fungus that increased the growth of the rice plants by fivefold. Very interesting, which I thought was huge. You know, but again, I don't know how that will translate ultimately to yield. But think about that. That's a very interesting application.
I mean, perhaps they will be able to have two growing seasons.
Yeah.
Right?
Who knows?
Ultimately, hopefully it'll increase the yield.
Yeah. And this report says that rice is the most important crop globally, you know, food crop. You know, we think over here, obviously we eat a lot of rice, but we also eat a lot of wheat and other things. But in other parts of the world, rice is it. You know, it's very important food staple.
I just hope that, you know, this works out so well that everybody on the planet is kind of eating this rice. Next thing you know, we're all turned into zombies.
The zombie rice?
That'd be cool.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Jay, how come you're not gushing over this week's science or fiction results?
I'm not unhappy. I really actually don't care if I win or lose.
Apparently.
Just that I learned.
Jay, can you give us a quote this week?
Oh,
hi.
Dang.
Hi, Steve. How you doing?
All right, so I have a different I tried to mix it up. I found a bunch of quotes that are stupid things that perhaps not so stupid people said.
Okay.
Okay.
So
you going to tell us the quotes first and then the people?
Yes, I will. Yeah, well, I'm not going to shout out these people's names because they don't deserve
okay.
it. You know, I'm not regaling them with "you're awesome." I'm going to just call them silly, stupid, ignorant, whatever. Ready? Louis Pasteur's theory of germs is ridiculous fiction. Pierre Pache.
Pierre.
He was a professor of physiology at Toulouse in 1872. Next one, we are probably nearing the limit of all we can know about astronomy.
Oh, yeah.
That was said by Simon Newcomb, astronomer, 1888.
Whoa.
Heavier than air flying machines are impossible. Lord Kelvin.
Kelvin.
Yep, 1895.
Kelvin, by the way, can I go on a little side thing here? Kelvin also thought that the Earth could only be like 100 million years old, you know, because of the temperature of the Earth. He was one of those guys who was brilliant but became so arrogant that he started to say stupid things about other disciplines outside of his specialty, and that's why we end up quoting him 100 years later.
Yeah, but Steve, I think it's funny you should say that one because I think – I remember reading a story about that, and I think he did hedge his bets a bit when Kelvin said that. He kind of said, well, you know, unless there's another source of energy, the Earth is, you know, so many years old. Which is in effect exactly why, you know, he wasn't aware of radioactivity.
Yes, and,
you know,
that's exactly
if,
right.
If there was no radioactivity, the Earth would be just solid rock
but,
at this point.
But
so,
the hubris was in him yes. thinking that his thermodynamic calculations trumped the entire field of geology.
Right.
Meanwhile, it was because he didn't know about radioactive decay, you know, heating the Earth. So that's the cautionary tale. What else, Jay? What else you got for us?
Okay, I got this one was from H.M. Warner from Warner Brothers, 1927, and he said, "Who the hell wants to hear actors talk?"
Oh.
And then I can't leave the a bad taste in everybody's mouth. This is a quote from Winston Churchill.
Ooh,
man will occasionally stumble over the truth, but usually manages to pick himself up, walk over or around it, and carry on. Winston Churchill.
He was the goods.
Woo!
He rocked.
Oh, he was one of my favorites.
You know, these quotes that I brought up, I picked people that probably were not stupid or considered stupid, and this might be assuming too much, but you know, they were respected for one reason or another, seem to be very knowledgeable in their fields, but yet they can make incredibly ridiculous statements like these. You know, it's easy for us to say that because we're looking back.
We actually quoted Steven Pinker at one time saying this, that making predictions about the future is an invitation to look stupid, right?
Yeah.
That if you're going to make pronouncements like, this is impossible, this will never happen,
right.
you're asking for it, unless you're really sure you know what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
Just one quick announcement this week. We are already organizing the NexusCon 2011 in the spring of 2011. This will be probably around the end of April, but we're still nailing down a date. If you are interested in volunteering to help us organize that con, then please contact us at info@necsscon.org. And I'll also point out that the DVDs for the 2009 NexusCon are available for purchase from the NexusCon.org website. So take a look. Well, thanks for joining me again this week, guys.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good night.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.